You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. In the early 1990s at the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles, Karen Ishizuka began organizing an exhibition to tell the stories of the Japanese Americans incarcerated in prison camps during World War II. Ishizuka, a third-generation Japanese-American, says she has been amazed and humbled by the stories she's heard from the people who lived in the camps. More than 120,000 people lived in the camps, two-thirds of them native-born American citizens, from 1942 to 1946. Karen Ishizuka is now the author of a book that grew out of the exhibition, the title Lost and Found, Reclaiming the Japanese-American Incarceration. Karen is our guest this afternoon. She says the book is meant to, in her words, contemplate the questions of what becomes history and from whose point of view. It asks how people can be encouraged to face dark moments and come away even stronger. It considers why we should remember when many would just as soon forget. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Karen Ishizuka is a writer and award-winning documentary producer. She served the Japanese American National Museum for its first 15 years as senior curator, senior producer, and director of its Media Arts Center. Her book, Lost and Found, Reclaiming the Japanese American Incarceration, is published by the University of Illinois Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Karen, welcome.
Thank you.
So nice to talk with you.
Thank you, Celeste. Nice to be here.
You did not live in a camp, but your parents, grandparents, and other relatives did. However, you say you inherited the indignity of camp. Would you talk about that?
Yes. You know, I think that myself, along with probably everybody of my generation, although we were not physically in camp, we grew up not only hearing just very obliquely about references to this mysterious place and time called camp, but also sort of the childbearing practices that their own experience lent them to pass on to us. For example, having been falsely accused and imprisoned, I think they were always told that they needed to prove, they always felt that they needed to prove themselves. And this, I think, was passed down to us. We, as Sansei, always thought we needed to be better, we needed to make good grades, and it was, you know, it was beyond just the tradition of don't bring shame to the family name. I think a lot of it was an attempt to show them, meaning, I don't know who at that point, them, the American government, them, the people of the United States, that it was wrong to have put them into camp. And so we were sort of an extension of themselves in trying to right what was in their minds a wrong.
Mm-hmm. And Sensei is third generation Japanese American.
Yes, Sansei.
Sansei, excuse me. Yes, okay. You say you grew up hearing about time being divided before the war and after the war, but virtually nothing about how your elders had spent those years during the war. When did you first learn about what had happened to your family and other Japanese Americans during World War II?
You know, I think it wasn't until I was in college. When I look on it, there may have been some slight reference when we were studying U.S. history to World War II. But I don't ever recall hearing or learning about it during high school. It was only in college and afterwards where the community itself, and this was, you know, in the mid-60s, you know, and at a time when people were really questioning why they didn't hear about their own histories, questioning Eurocentric values that may not apply to them. It was a time of a lot of questioning and a lot of going ahead on your own and finding out what you needed to find out.
So I
did a lot of research, talked to a lot of people, and actually wrote my master's thesis, which was 1971, which was fairly early for the literature. There was very little literature at that time, so a lot of it came from my own talking to family members and talking to community members.
Yeah, Lost and Found is such a terrific title. It's so accurately describes what happened.
Yeah, I think, you know, we lost a period of time. I lost a history and lost some dignity. And I think that in the process of recovering history, we're actually recovering from history. So it's lost and found.
Yeah. What's it been like for first and second generation Japanese Americans to reclaim this history?
You know, I think at this point, probably three quarters or so of the people who were in camp, I'm not sure if it's three quarters, but certainly three quarters of the Issei, the first generation, are already gone, and many of the Nisei are gone as well. And I think it's just now that as we find out more and more what their experiences were, you're finding out more and more what has not yet been untold. You know, you hate to indicate a period of time or anything as a sort of a scapegoat for everything else that are problems in your time, in your life. However, it is so much can be traced back to those years of being really betrayed by your own government. The Issei lost. They were adults. They had lived in this country some 20, 30, 40 years. They lost everything they had because they had to leave their homes and businesses within a very short period of time, a couple of weeks, and were able to take only what they could carry, which were often their children. The Nisei were those children, the second generation, and they had grown up as Americans, as having pledged allegiance to the United States, of really believing in equality and liberty and justice for all. And so this had to have greatly affected their own ability to trust and confidence, you know, within of their government, and as well as their, you know, sort of whole situation.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Karen Ishizuka, author of Lost and Found, Reclaiming the Japanese American Incarceration. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone who's waiting on the toll-free line. A listener in Chicago, line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon. We know that this took place on the West Coast. About 110,000 Japanese were interned. Now, it didn't take place in other parts of the country, and I wondered, how were those people treated?
You know, it did happen in odd places like Alaska and Hawaii. And actually, people of Japanese ancestry who were Peruvians and South Americans were also...
Well, did it happen to Canadian Japanese as well?
The Canadian government did have an incarceration of their own. They did as well.
Yeah, so, now when they finally began taking the Japanese Americans into the service, were they restricted to the European theater?
They were first considered ineligible, right, for service, and then when they served in many, many places, including Okinawa and Japan, as well as the European theater.
Yeah, because from what I gather now, this is a unit that did so well in Italy that the Japanese are so proud of and should be. I gather that it sounds like they were just used as cannon fodder.
That is something that has often come up for discussion, and I think when you look at the statistics and you see...
You know, 100% casualties. I don't know of any other unit
It is considered of its size to have the most casualties and deaths.
Yeah, it's I know they weren't interned here in Chicago, but I just wondered how they were treated. And, you know, how did they justify doing it to the Japanese and not doing it to the Germans and the Italians?
I think that from the commission hearings that were held in the 1980s, the government commission itself concluded that it was a matter of racial prejudice and that the government itself did not do its job. So it did clearly place it on racial prejudice and the failure of democracy.
And
when the compensation bill came up, was there a lot of opposition?
Opposition from
everyone.
Well, yes, it was it was discussed a lot. You know, some within the community thought we should not ask for something. Some within the community thought we should ask for much more. Outside of the Japanese American community, I think that there was a lot of dissension both for and against. We had a lot of support from other civil rights groups, African American groups, Jewish groups, people who had been similarly mistreated, I think, really understood and supported it. There were, of course, people who thought that this was not just part of the hysteria that war brings on, and people should forget it and move on.
Well, I think it's important to bring this up, because if you don't, it's going to happen again.
And that's really the reason. That's really the reason that we did the exhibition. That's really the reason that I wrote the book. It really is not to cry over spilled milk. It is really to try to prevent something like this from ever happening again. That's why for our Japanese American community, it is so painful to see what is happening, the backlash against Muslim Americans, Arab Americans.
Yeah, you can see there is some similarity, you know, an unexpected attack and some of the racial hysteria. You can see it happening again, I guess.
Yes, it is a different form of racial profiling, but you would hope that the United States government would have learned from the past.
War against terrorists, yes, war against terrorists, not necessarily. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that was really news to me was the persons of Japanese ancestry who were deported from Latin American countries to the U.S. between 1942 and 1945. What a sad story that is.
Yes, and something that is still not well known. The government orchestrated a forcible deportation of over 2,000 people from 13 different Latin American countries, and they were supposed to have been used by the U.S. government as hostages in exchange for Americans held by Japan. It sounds, you know, quite odd, I think, at this point. But in the end, over 500 Japanese Peruvians were included in two prisoner of war exchanges that happened between 1942 and 43. And then the remaining Japanese Latin Americans continued to be incarcerated in the U.S. But after the war, they were considered illegal aliens. And the Peruvian government refused to readmit them back to their own country, even though they were Peruvian citizens. So, you know, as a result, you know, hundreds of Japanese Peruvians were deported to Japan, a country that they had never visited and had, you know, very little ties. And some 300 or so remained in the United States and fought deportation through the courts.
Is much known about what happened to those people who went to Japan who were not?
I don't know. There have been a couple of books written about this whole incident. I am not personally familiar with what happened to them once they, those who were deported to Japan.
Yeah. Maybe it would be helpful here to back up a little bit and give us a little background. What should we know at a minimum about how it was that Japanese Americans were forced into concentration camps during the Second World War?
Well, you know, the people talk about Pearl Harbor as the beginning, but there had been a very well-mounted and anti-Japanese sentiment and campaign that had been growing, especially on the West Coast, since the very early days. The Japanese were not allowed to own land. Well, backing up even more, they were not allowed to become naturalized citizens. So when you cannot become a citizen, then other things like not being able to own land and other rights of citizenship are withheld. So Japanese were not able to become citizens, naturalized citizens, actually, until 1952. So there had been a whole entire sentiment of anti-Japanese feeling. So by the time of Pearl Harbor, there had already been dossiers, for example, on all the Japanese immigrants who were considered leaders. When I looked to the National Archive, to the National Archives for my grandfather's dossiers, they were under surveillance for many years before the bombing of Pearl Harbor. As a matter of fact, there's a memo from J. Edgar Hoover in both of their dossiers that says that was dated before Pearl Harbor, that says that in the event of war with Japan, this person will be picked up. So it was, and in fact, on December 7th, there were many, many thousands of Japanese men picked up. So they must have, and they did have, quite a surveillance that was going on before that, and that was all a result of this intense anti-Japanese, anti-Asian, xenophobic feeling that permeated the West Coast at the time.
At the same time, though, we have the Munson Report.
Yes. Yeah. The Munson Report was one that was done in 1936, I think, that indicated, it was a secret report that indicated that Japanese in Hawaii, in the event of war, would be loyal to the United States, and there would be no threat to the United States. And yet this report was not made known. And although it was done in way before Pearl Harbor.
Hmm. So on February 19th of 1942, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066.
Right.
What did it order?
The executive order. It's interesting because it did not identify Japanese Americans per se, but it provided the government background and groundwork by which the Japanese on the West Coast would eventually be both expelled from their homes as well as incarcerated. So it was an executive order that eventually led to the incarceration of what turned out to be 120,000 people, first in and it was a very complex and layered incarceration. There were internment camps under the Justice Department that held the men, Issei men, who were picked up first, like my grandfathers. Then there was a system of assembly centers, which were holding pens, basically, for the families that were left behind. And then there was the system of the concentration camps, which were then called war relocation centers under the War Relocation Authority. And that was the third level of incarceration. So it was a very complex and very lengthy era. So it wasn't very orderly. I think people were being brought into camp even as they were being let out. So it was a very messy and prolonged process.
Were there voices raised against the executive order and the following incarceration?
There were, and this we don't hear enough of, I think. They were small voices, but they were voices nonetheless. The only national group in the country to come out in support of Japanese Americans and against the incarceration were the American Friends of Service Committee. And I think one chapter of the ACLU in Northern California, but the ACLU as a national organization did not. There wasn't a lot. There weren't loud voices. There were individual voices. There was an African American attorney in Los Angeles who voiced his opinion in the local papers. There were teachers, the librarians who sent books and wrote editorials. There were individual voices. But not many.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling to ascertain if there was any significant resistance within the Japanese American community to this internment, or did most, if not all, of the Japanese American citizenry meekly submit to government authority under President Roosevelt's executive order?
You know, that's something that we've asked a lot, and I think that we have to remember of the very repressive times that we were under. I think that something like that could never have happened in the way that it is happening, that it happened then at this point. The parents were not American citizens, so they had no constitutional rights at all in this country. So they could not go to the courts, they could not vote, they could not do anything that American citizens have. The Japanese that were citizens were children, mostly. So they also had very little recourse and understanding to their own rights as American citizens. However, having said that, there were many individuals and small organizations within the camps, within the Japanese American organizations, that very loudly, as much as they can, voiced their own opposition to this. The Fair Play Committee in Heart Mountain was a group of men who were of draft age. And they did. They ended up drafting Japanese Americans out of the camps, even while their parents were still in camp. And they said that they would go if their constitutional rights were given back. But they would not under those circumstances where they were considered disloyal and their parents, et cetera, were in camp. There were many, many at Heart Mountain. They were called the Fair Play Committee. But there were also other voices, other draft resistors, if you would want to call them, in the other camps. The Fair Play Committee went on, many of them went on to be convicted and went on to jail because of their beliefs. They were really true patriots. They said that they would serve and yet believed so much in the American government at the time that they would even serve under those circumstances if they were given their rights back. There's there's an article that I have in the book from the San Francisco Chronicle in 1944 that reports on 11 demands that were presented to the WRA. And these were from a group of people who were already in camp in Amache in Colorado. But they included demands such as the immediate and more vigorous efforts by the government toward enlightening the American public with the truth about Japanese in America, that all of their constitutional rights and privileges be reinstituted, and that the United States government establish adequate precautionary measures so that wrongful incarceration never again be repeated with any group because of race, color, or creed. You know, and this, to me, was really astounding. It does show that they went because they had very little recourse, but they did not go as meekly as even myself and others might have thought when we first started looking into this. You know, and this last demand that indicates that wrongful incarceration should never be repeated, you know, that's even at the moment that they are themselves in the throes of being wrongfully incarcerated. So it shows that they had both the wherewithal, the humanism, the sort of the political understanding that this might happen to another group. So, you know, there were voices of opposition. How loud they were amplified, I don't know. You know, I just happened to find this when I was doing the research on the exhibition. But, you know, this was a small article that was in the San Francisco Chronicle. How many people looked at it, how many government officials acted upon it or were influenced by it, I don't know. There were also, I have to say, some women's organizations within the camps that were very, very vocal. And I think that we often don't give women, especially Japanese-American women during that time, much credit for taking control of their own lives. But both within the camps and without the camps, within and outside of the camps, within they had petitions for better schools, better food, more medication, better facilities to live by. Outside the camp, the group wrote to not President Roosevelt, but to Mrs. Roosevelt. And the letter is truly amazing because it says they appeal to her as a woman. They say, you know, I would hope that you, as a woman, would understand what we are going through. So there were voices of opposition, and it's something that we really need to hold on to and learn more about.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
How was it that as curator of the exhibition at the Japanese American National Museum, you decided you wanted to make it a participatory event?
This, you know, I was very, one of my mentors in the whole field of museum exhibitry was Jack Chen, who is now the director of the Asian Pacific American Center at NYU. He was the founder of the Chinese Historical Museum in New York. He, as well as other people like Lonnie Bunch, who is now at the African American Museum Project at the Smithsonian, Claudine Brown, who was the first director of that African American museum, Tomas Ibarra Frausto. There are many, many people who have worked in the area of museums in trying to get museums out of a traditional mode of there's the experts and the visitors are the learners. They provided, well, Jack specifically provided a what he calls a dialogic museum, and it really he dialogic exhibit or museum that actively engages with the audience in mutually exploring their own histories. So he points out that, you know, the reflection of one's own history in a museum exhibit gives a recognition to the individuals and groups that are normally passed over by such official versions of history, and that looking at the past together provides a touchstone for their interpreting and better understanding the present, and in so doing, the broader audience does as well. So Jack and others had provided me with this theory of building a more participatory, dialogic, interactive experience. And then Ralph Applebaum, who was the designers, we discussed that concept with him and the design team, and they also came up with really wonderful ways to actually physically implement those in the exhibition itself. One way was, we had camp maps. We had maps of each of the camps, and Ralph had come up with the idea that instead of having the maps already populated with teeny tiny barracks, that one way that we could both fabricate the maps and also engage the participants was to have people who were in that camp register, meaning to put their name down, put their block number down, and find out, you know, exactly where they were. And then they would be given a little barracks, and they themselves could place it onto the large camp maps. Now, this was a physical way of reclaiming the camps, the act of writing their names, of remembering their block number and their barracks number, receiving a small little barracks, going to the map and finding their block on this huge map, and placing it there. What was actually, you know, in theory it sounded great, but it actually turned out to be quite a small but meaningful gesture that they could physically do. Many were seen hoisting their children, their grandchildren, up and allowing them to place the barracks in sort of a physical way. They were really passing this experience and this legacy down. We had other ways. Volunteers took Polaroid photos of anyone who was in camp. That meant both the inmate as well as staff, teachers, workers. We had a lot of non-Japanese American people who had staffed the camps come in, and they were also invited to have their photo taken. And then people who had passed on and had their descendants were also invited to represent them by having their own photo taken, and they were then placed in what we called camp albums that grew over time with the exhibition. Mm-hmm. And they really put faces to the numbers, and it became a source and it became part of the exhibition that people spent as much time at as they did with the formal exhibition. People went through the albums. As time went on, these albums grew. One of my favorite stories was one of our volunteers, Lois Padilla, working with a volunteer to help her maneuver this, and she was looking at the camp albums, and she just yelped and said, "Oh, I found my first boyfriend." And then she paused and said, "Oh, but he got so old." So, you know, there was so much life that was going on within the exhibition on a day-by-day basis. And this is one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book. These are all things that would be ephemeral if it were not written down in this form. So really, there are so much wonderful things that happened that like this that I did really want to put them down in,
yeah,
in the book.
One of the moving stories included in Lost and Found involves a man who came into the museum with a box, and you spoke with him.
Yes.
You want to tell us the story?
Yes, it was on the first day, and we were just exhausted. I tell you, everybody worked so hard. We had been there, 14, 16, 18 hours a day, at the last minute trying to put everything together. And I was up in my office, and one of the volunteers called me and said, well, there's this man downstairs, and we're just closing up, but I don't know, you should maybe want to come down and talk to him. He wants to talk to someone. So I thought, okay, I am a really firm believer that, everybody has a story to tell, and this person really made me a strong believer. Anyway, it was a Caucasian man, and he had a box, and he was quite nervous, and I really was wondering, was he homeless? Was he not all there? Because he really could hardly connect a sentence. And as he spoke, he kept fiddling with his box, and he finally opened the box and slowly brought out its contents. And then I realized, yes, this did have, was quite an appropriate story for him to bring in. To make a long story short, it turned out that this box was his grandmother's, who had passed. No, his mother's, I'm sorry, his mother's, who had passed away several years ago, and he found while they were cleaning up, it was locked, so he never thought anything about it until he found some keys, and he went through key by key by key until he opened it up. Inside, there was a picture of a Japanese man, some government papers, and other things that he had to wonder what had this to do with his mother. And then he saw a photo of a Caucasian woman with this Japanese man. And as he read through them, it turned out that this must have been one of his relatives. He talked to his cousins, he talked to his aunts, he talked to everybody he could, and found out that this indeed was his grandfather, that his grandfather was Japanese, had married this Caucasian woman, and when the war broke out, he went to camp saying that he was a single man in the attempt to save his family from being incarcerated. So he did so. He went to camp as a single man. He had kept some touch with his family, but in the years that ensued, as he was transferred from camp to camp, he slowly lost contact with the family. His mother, who was half Japanese, had never told his son, this man who had come in. And it was just a very special moment for me, because I think I was in the presence of someone who was really searching very deeply and allowing this person to hear it. He said things like, "Well, here I was, this white man, or I used to be, with prejudices. I admit I had prejudices, and now." Now I don't know. I don't know who I am. So it was very poignant. Although the exhibit was closed, I asked him if he would like to go through. I turned the lights on, and he was just amazed at the enormity of the situation, and to think that his grandfather had been swept up in this. And it really made him sympathetic to this person, this grandfather that he had never known.
Yeah.
So he had many more things that he wanted to bring. He traveled, actually. He had to drive 2 hours to get to the exhibition. He had just heard about it on the radio and impulsively got in the car, grabbed that box, and came. And he said he had a lot more things, and if he could bring them up, and I said that I would very much like to see them, but he never did. And, you know, it was something that I had his number, but I think, you know, it was up to him because he also was going through something that was much greater than a historical exhibit. He was really reevaluating his life and trying to find out who he was. And I think, you know, maybe the reason we tell strangers things is that they are indeed strangers. So, you know, it was a very poignant story that I feel very privileged to have been there.
It's an amazing story of the collision of history and politics.
Yes, and personal effects.
And in identity.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing story.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why, you know, that chapter I included was, you know, many stories that literally walked through the door like that. We were totally unprepared, but those stories, Los Japoneses, Gabon, Español, and the classified Caucasians, they really showed that the incarceration really affected many, many more people than just Japanese Americans, and hence it really is an American story and not just a Japanese American story or a story that happened a long time ago. I think both the personal and the political implications for us as Americans and for this country are something that we all should learn from.
Yeah. What was the response of non-Japanese Americans to the exhibition?
We were quite gratified that probably 50% at the end, I forgot, but I think it was a good 50% of the end, at the end, were not Japanese Americans who came. We had, I don't have those statistics with me, but there were some 70,000, I think, over the course of the exhibition here in Los Angeles, and a good 50 to 60 were not Japanese Americans. So that was great. I think that the people who came were mostly, wanting, as I was, to learn more about your country. We had youth, we had people from other countries, and people from other countries, their reaction was very interesting, too, because they also had learned, as we did, that America is the land of freedom and opportunity. So they were quite shocked to know that this had happened in the United States. There were a few people who, and this happened on more than one occasion, who came up and asked me or other staff people at the museum, where did this take place? And, you know, even though we had Japanese American, the text revealed it, we had a huge map of the United States that, you know, every school child recognizes as such, with the camps indicated on this map. But I think the cognitive dissonance was so great that these people could not really digest that this happened in the United States. So that was one of the more shocking reactions, is that, you know, even when told, it was still so difficult to believe. It really took a little while to talk to them that this did actually happen in the U.S. Well,
I can only give you a minute on this last question, but I thought it was very interesting that the exhibition opened a week after Proposition 187 was passed by California voters. And that drew some comments from museum goers. What kind of connections were made there?
There was so many connections, and, you know, this was another way that really the community curated the show. Prop 187, it was just passed right about when the exhibition opened, and the parallels to the xenophobia against Japanese Americans then and Mexican Americans, Latinos now were really, really tremendous. In the comment books, there was so much written about that. People really brought up the parallels, and really it brought history to the fore, and it showed that history does matter, and that the similar things were happening then, you know, as they are now, And I think it's these historical things that we need to connect the dots between what has happened and what is happening, and what we could do so that it never happens again in the future. And I think that's what the lessons of all of this was, Prop 187, the World War II incarceration, the post-9/11 backlash. These are all things that we need to realize that history does matter, and the personal is very political.
Mm. There we have to leave it. Karen, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. It was my pleasure.
Karen Ishizuka is a writer and award-winning documentary producer. She served the Japanese American National Museum for its first 15 years as senior curator, senior producer, and director of its Media Arts Center. Her book, Lost and Found, Reclaiming the Japanese American Incarceration, is published by the University of Illinois Press.